Hey there, everybody. Welcome to another bonus episode of the Hugo Is There podcast. This time I have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Paul Bryans, retired professor of English, including science fiction, at Washington State University, and author of the book Common Errors in English Usage and the website by the same name. But I do want to emphasize that it is a book. Years and years ago, probably 25 plus years ago, I discovered the website and used it regularly, referred to it regularly. And then I think I must have lost my bookmark or something, and so I didn't go back to it for a long time. And just recently, I thought about it again and went to the website, poked around on it a little bit, and discovered, of course, what I now know, that the author of that website was a professor at Washington State University, which isn't that far away from me, who also taught science fiction. And the website has a ton of resources on it as well. And so I sent off an email to Dr. Bryans, and he kindly consented to come on my podcast. And we just have kind of a meandering conversation talking about science fiction films, books, the Common Errors in English Usage page and book, and other things as well. So I hope you enjoy this discussion, and I'll just hand you over to Paul and me in the past. Well, it is now my great pleasure to be joined by Dr. Paul Bryans. So hi there, Paul.
Hi.
It's really great to talk to you. It's one of those interesting experiences that you get sometimes on my podcast. Some of my other guests are podcasters, and I'm used to hearing them in my ears all the time, but not while actually speaking to them. So I've been binging your podcast lately, and we'll talk about that as we get there. But for any of my listeners who don't know you, why don't you give us a little bit of your background?
Well, I was always interested in literature and decided finally to go to Indiana University and get a PhD in comparative literature, among other things, studying medieval languages. So my dissertation was on Middle English, Old French, and Middle High German literary parody. And I spun off of that my first book, which is called Bawdy Tales from the Courts of Medieval France. And nice. So that's what got me tenure, interestingly enough. It's published by Harper and Row. But I taught for 40 years at Washington State University in Pullman. I was hired especially to work with and eventually run a program in humanities, which was international literature, music, film, dance, poetry, art, architecture, all kinds of stuff. I had a lot of freedom to do a lot of different things. And they had a popular course there taught by the chair in the detective fiction. And he said, how would you like to teach a course in science fiction? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I haven't really been into it much since I was a kid, started college. But sure, why not? So I got back into it. So I started in the seventh grade. A friend of mine, Tony Stower, used to walk around the school grounds with me at lunchtime and tell me stories he had read in galaxy and science fiction and fantasy. Mm. And he would, he'd just tell me the whole story from beginning to end.
Right.
So that was my introduction to science fiction. And I subscribed to those magazines and got into it and read quite a lot, especially got hooked on Isaac Asimov. But I had a very brief correspondence with him at one point. Mm. I told him he ought to write one of his books, sort of introducing. He had written about the Bible, but in sort of just literary ways, and he hadn't paid any attention to the modern scholarship that traces what the actual culture that's behind it and, which undermines a lot of the religious beliefs. And he wrote me back a postcard saying, if you do that kind of thing, they will kill you. said, oh, brave Mr. Asimov. Well, he actually did do that. It took him about 10 years. But
okay.
Anyway, so in between graduating from high school in Petaluma, California, and going to college, I concentrated. Well, and then getting my job, I concentrated on world literature, especially French, and did lots of work. Taught classes on interdisciplinary studies and so on. Even taught French for a short while, but I was a bad French teacher. I fired myself, and Then I wound up coordinating the program I'd been hired to teach in, humanities. And I did a whole lot of other stuff. Anyway, so those are the two segments of my life in which science fiction was really important to me when I was a kid, up through high school graduation, and then in my early career as a professor.
Did you ever have occasion to read one of the stories that your friend related to you and find out that he had mangled it?
No, I can't say I have. He was a good storyteller. He had an excellent memory.
Nice. You mentioned ancient languages and that kind of stuff. And I'm just going to jump right into some science fiction here. And sorry, this is off the curriculum, but it you brought it up. So one of my pet peeves in science fiction is when people travel, you know, hundreds of years into the past, into places that today speak English, and everyone's just speaking English, and they're not speaking Middle French or you know, some other language. Is that the kind of thing that bothers you as well?
You're just talking about time travel stories.
Yeah.
I've read somewhere the person had to know the language. It doesn't bother me a lot. It bothers me more when they have people in ancient times speaking modern English. But of course, that's been the hip thing to do on movies, on streaming series these days.
Yes.
So everything comes in and out. It doesn't bother me a lot. It's just something people do in order to facilitate
their, it's an expedient, writing. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. It bothers me more when they're all the aliens they run into in space have are two-legged mammals with just a few bumps on their face.
Yeah. That's the Star Trek thing, right? Fancy forehead configurations. So, you know, I discovered you through the common errors in English usage. I mean, I discovered that page back in the, I think, the late 90s when I started my career out of college. And for the most part, I would go there whenever I needed, you know, a clarification on something. And then what it became, and I'm sure you've heard this many times, is you click through to read one thing and then you just fall down a click hole and spend hours because it's also, and you know, as a compliment, it's very, very well done, very entertainingly written as well. It's not dry in any way.
Thank you. That's what I really aim at.
Yeah. I did have the flip calendar at some point. I bought one of them.
Oh, wow.
One of the daily flip calendars. So that was fun. I saved them at some point and they were on my desk at work, but I've moved offices too many times to probably have kept them. But there's so much other information on your Washington State University page because you have things like, and I wanted to just point some of these things out. There's a syllabus for an online graduate level science fiction course. So you know, if anybody's interested in what would you be studying in a graduate level science fiction course, it's all right there.
Yeah, I put up a lot of old syllabuses. This is probably what you're looking at.
Yeah, and you know, science fiction research bibliographies. If you want to write about it, you know, there's lots of resources about that. Lots of information about science fiction film as well. And I definitely want to touch on film as well as books. My podcast mostly focuses on the written, but occasionally you know, we talk about films as well. And you know, information about nuclear holocausts. And you've done extensive work there as well.
Yeah, 10 years of research for that, and many publications.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you had sent me an op-ed that you did. I can't remember what the subtitle was, evoking Dr. Strangelove, kind of how we learned to love the bomb, right?
Yeah.
Or at least not fear it.
Yeah, that was published in the New York Times.
Yeah.
I guess I didn't put it in these notes. Yeah, that was my most widespread thing. I ran into somebody, one of my colleagues was in Chile on a leave and read my piece, which had been in the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune, which used to, you know, print things from the New York Times in Chile. That common errors in English usage was definitely the biggest thing I ever did. I was the first person in my department to use the internet. I had been on earlier iterations of what preceded the internet, but I got this idea from my chair who had published a book called Common Errors in Student Writing. And I thought, and he was just selling it to his students. And I said, would you mind if I did something like that? And I won't use your writing. I'll use my own examples and my own writing, but I'll borrow the title and I call it Common Errors in writing, I guess it was. I can't remember what I originally called it, but it ultimately became usage.
Right.
And it was the very first thing of its kind that had been on the internet. And so for a long time in Google, if you were looking up a misusage like, is ain't correct? Right. It would send you directly to my site. So I had hundreds of thousands of visitors, and it just mushroomed like crazy. Mm-hmm. Well, ultimately, you know, serious dictionaries like Webster's and others began to take over, and there were a lot of books being published and so on. So it shrank back. And then several years ago, we moved the website to a more secure, long-lasting location. So the URL changed. So I lost a lot of contacts. But Nevertheless, people still get in touch with me all the time about it.
Yeah. Well, and that's what happened here as well. Whereas I just finally kind of poked around the page enough to notice, oh, there's an email address. I should just fire off an email. By the way, the opinion piece that I was referencing was called Americans Learn to Love the Bomb. And I want to circle back to that at some point, but let's stick with common errors for a while.
Okay.
Now I don't want to make you reiterate everything you talked about in an entire series of podcasts on the Common Errors in English Usage podcast about the origins of it. But one thing stuck out to me that it didn't necessarily come from you seeing a bunch of errors from your students. There were some other errors that were bothering you initially.
Right. The mistakes students make tend to be quite different from the ones that I was interested in. Yeah. I really wanted to help people, you know, that not just things that annoy me. It's things that I think get people into trouble.
Right.
In one of the podcasts, I talked about that there even today, there are certain employers who will not look further on a job application if mm-hmm. there's a misspelling in it that they don't like. Right. There are many women who will not date you
right.
if they see you using what they consider misuse.
Right.
So a lot of people, when they think about the usage guides, think it's an opportunity for high-handed people to tell everybody what's wrong.
Yes.
And I know what's right, and I'm telling you, you sound stupid.
Right.
I wanted to avoid that, especially stuff like Lynn Truss's book, Eat, Shoots, and Leaves, mm-hmm. if you've ever read that. The kind of thing that calls is called a grammar Nazi.
Right.
And I do not want to be identified with the grammar Nazis. Instead, I was trying to be supportive and entertaining. And the idea is, you know, this is really common usage, mm-hmm. but you might run into trouble if you turn it in on a paper to your teacher, because this is a pet peeve with a lot of English teachers. Mm-hmm. Although I find students were more likely to be corrected in their writing by chemistry teachers or music teachers than they were mm-hmm. English teachers. I don't want to go into why that should be at the college level, but that's another pet peeve of mine.
I can definitely appreciate that attitude about it. I read a book a number of years ago called Grammar Snobs Are Great Big Meanies. And that it kind of changed my mind about, you know, don't be a jerk and correct people. If they need help with something, help them.
Yeah.
And I definitely appreciate that in some of the entries, it'll say, you know, if you're writing in an academic setting, if you're writing for a publication, you'll want to avoid this usage. But in common talking, don't worry about it.
Well, the examples that you sent me really lend themselves to this point. So why don't we talk about those?
Yeah, let's do that. I mean, the one that just bothers me, because I know it's wrong, it's always wrong, but it's so ubiquitous as to just at this point be, I think, a lost cause, is the improper use of begs the question.
Yeah, I just heard that yesterday on the radio. So here's what I wrote about it. An argument that improperly assumes as true the very point the speaker is trying to argue for is said in traditional logic to beg the question. Here is an example of a question begging argument. This painting is trash because it's obviously worthless. The speaker is simply asserting the worthlessness of the work, not presenting any evidence to demonstrate that this is in fact the case. Mm-hmm. Since we never use begs with this odd meaning to improperly take for granted in any other phrase, most people now suppose the phrase implies something quite different, that the argument demands that a question about it be asked, raises the question. Although using the expression in its original sense is now rare, using it in the newer sense will cause irritation among traditionalists.
Right.
And those who went out of my way to identify who it's going to bother. I didn't say it's wrong.
Correct.
I would say it's standard now. Standard, but annoying to people who know the original expression. So it's up to you to decide. Do you care about those people? Is your audience, if your audience all uses that expression and they're comfortable with it, go ahead. But there's a perfectly good expression to raise the question, which makes a lot more sense because begging sounds odd in that expression anyway.
Yeah. It may be one of those things that started off as someone trying to sound erudite using something, you know, maybe they know that it's a formal logic thing, but I think the fact that question is in it makes people think, well, then if there's not a question here, then why would I use that? And since there is a question, yes, it begs the question. So the next one that I had is comprised of.
Right. Although comprise is used primarily to mean to include, it is also often stretched to mean is made up of, a meaning that some critics object to. The most cautious route is to avoid using of after any form of comprise and substitute is composed of. In sentences like this, Jimmy's paper on Marxism was composed entirely of sentences copied off the Marx Brothers homepage. There's a lot of disagreement about the proper use of comprise, but most authorities agree that the whole comprises the parts. Our pets comprise one dog, two cats, and a turtle. The whole comes first, then comprise, followed by the parts. But there's so much confusion surrounding the usage of this word that it may be better to avoid it altogether.
Very good.
And so there, that's one of the other things. This is something that doesn't particularly bother me. Mm-hmm. I used to get tons of emails saying, oh, why don't you write up this one,
right.
The other one. This is one that was sent to me. I looked it up, researched it, and decided, I see it bothers some people, so yeah. I should write it up, alert people to it. But the easiest way to avoid any problem is just don't use it.
Yeah, yeah. In terms of English usage, there's more than one school, right? The prescriptivist and the descriptivist. and you can... It's possible to kind of blend them. And I feel like your website really does because it uses the word errors, right? Common errors in English usage. But a lot of the entries really sort of moderate that towards, here's a better way to do it. But you're still kind of describing what the language is at the same time.
Yeah. Linguists invented the term prescriptionism to describe this as if the people who are writing and talking were telling people how to write and talk, and some of them do. But really, they're describing what many people find incorrect, not just them.
Right.
And when there's actually an organization called Bridging the Unbridgeable, I think, linguists write about people like me. I actually did a podcast interview with the president of this. Yeah. And so they feel very superior because they say, oh, look, these unprofessional people who don't know language usage, we know that our real job is to describe how language is used, to study it. And when it changes, you have to be alert to change with it.
Yeah.
And going around trying to get people to put the brakes on and go back to things that they were taught in first grade is just presumptuous and rude and unscientific.
Right.
Well, right. I think that they're being unscientific because the one thing that most of them don't do is go out and see who are the people who are objecting besides the people that write the books. Is it teachers? That's a pretty important group to pay attention to. Is it women? Is it employers? You know, is it people who have recently learned the language from another country? Mm-hmm. Is it people who come from England? These are all traps you can fall into. So to me, what I'm doing is descriptive too. It's describing how the usage comes across to various people.
Yeah. Talking about speakers of other languages, in my career, I've worked with people from a number of countries. One time I was working with a guy from India, and I asked him about an update that he was putting in to something. And he replied to me that he had not yet completed the updation. And I thought, that's a very logical, from the way English works, that sounds like it should be valid. It just made me smile. So.
Right. Well, I spent a good chunk of the career at the end of my time at the university studying South Asian literature and English. So I'm very familiar with some of the quirks in Indian English, which has its own patterns. And there's enough of them that they make a substantial, respectable body.
Yeah. So then I have two in there. I can't remember if I had two in when I sent you the email, but two that are sort of blood related, where one of them is staunch versus stanch, and the other one is gout being used as a verb rather than a noun.
Yeah. I've never run into gout as a verb. So
I ran into both of these in a book that I read last week.
Oh, that's odd. To gout something? How did you gout?
No, it said that blood gouted.
Oh,
instead of there was a gout of blood.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, that's the kind of inventive invention of words that almost makes sense. If it was in a poem, it would be great.
Right, right. Well, but, that, I think it's important to keep in mind too, right? The languages change and evolve over time, and and that's where the descriptivist camp comes in.
But not all at once. It's not like when the franc was discarded and the euro became the money of France.
Right.
It stops and then you have to shift over. It's much more messy, like a wave coming in on a beach and dragging back some stuff with it and mixed all up with old pieces of things. Yeah.
Well, that kind of is English in a nutshell, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, staunch and stanch, this is one that I wasn't really aware of until somebody called it my attention. Some people, and not a few usage guides, insist that although you can be a staunch friend, you stanch the flow of blood from a wound. But staunch has been a standard spelling for the word with the latter meaning from its origin in the 14th century and is today more popular than stanch.
Wow.
So this is one of those that I call a non-error.
Right. Okay.
The two words spelled staunch are logically related through a root meaning watertight. You are tight with your allies and friends, clinging firmly to them, and you close a wound tightly to halt the bleeding. Even people who write stanch often pronounce it staunch.
Right. I think of that one in the context of champing at the bit. I wonder if British English is that chomping at the bit, because that's in American English, you change it to an O, right? Well, you don't, but that the usage goes that way sometimes.
Well, I recently heard, I think on TV, two uses of stanch. And I said, oh, well, people are actually saying that. So they both exist. Good to know. But I think it's very unlikely you get into trouble for saying staunch the blood.
Okay. Well, I will stop correcting people on that one. I can't remember how – well, we just had I think I alerted you to this one. I heard somebody say Groundhog's Day the other day. We were recording this right after Groundhog Day. That one – I can see where it comes from. We have a lot of Mother's Day, Father's Day, Secretary's Day, Indigenous People's Day.
Yeah.
But it's not a day celebrating groundhogs. It's
right.
It's a day where a groundhog does a thing.
Yeah.
But it bothers me. Another recent one, and this is another one I don't remember if I put on the list, was people using verse instead of verses when saying, the Chiefs versus the Eagles. They'll say Chiefs versus the Eagles. And I don't know where that comes from. To me, it makes me think that someone thinks that versus is a plural word. But
yeah, well, there's two kinds of versus, V-E-R-S-E-S and V-E-R-S-U-S. So here's what I wrote about that. The V-S period in a law case like Brown versus the Board of Education stands for Latin versus, meaning against. Don't confuse it with the word for lines of poetry, V-E-R-S-E-S, when describing other conflicts like the upcoming football game featuring Oaksdale versus Pinewood. Right. Note that in formal legal context, the abbreviation is usually just V as in Brown v. the Board of Education.
Right.
And that's something I didn't realize. I'm sure I'd heard it, but until I did some research on it. Of course, I've read a lot of other usage guides, looking for examples.
I was literally talking with a couple of friends the other day about verse and verses, and somebody said, no, just use V. And I said, no, that's more of a legal context. And, and he said, what? And I went, no, seriously. And the other one that I hear often is I feel badly.
Yeah, that's what's called a a hypercorrection. Because...
Well, you're just assuming that feel is a verb, therefore I need to use the adverb form of bad, yeah, right?
Right. Yeah, right, exactly. It's because there's a verb followed by an adverb, mm-hmm, feel badly. But not all adverbs end in ly.
Right.
And a lot of words function as both adjectives and adverbs, and in, mm-hmm, this case, bad is the traditional example. I feel bad. Right. Mm-hmm. But there's something that sounds a little unsophisticated about that. I feel, yeah, really bad. You know, it's a three-letter word, which puts it, yes, in a category of children and people who don't know much. So it's what we call a hypercorrection, where you try to make it sound more sophisticated and you, mm-hmm, wind up sounding,
right,
like you don't know what you're talking about. The other example is that I use for hypercorrection is for you and I.
Yes. It sounds sophisticated.
Right. And I wrote this, I had occasion to go into this in detail recently. There's a writer for the New York Times named Peter Coy, and he writes on finance mainly. And in one of his newsletters, he was doing research on this very question, and he had an interesting way of analyzing it. He thought it had to do with social class, that people who feel that they might be perceived as being uneducated or poor will hypercorrect more often, mm-hmm, to try to sound more sophisticated, and they wind up sounding ignorant instead.
Okay.
He got in contact with me, and we actually had a phone conversation and talked for half an hour. Mm. And I'll give you what came out that was printed in his newsletter. In the first camp are those who say, me and him got a six-pack, as well as the six-pack is for him and me and him. They're overusing me and him. It's wrong in the first sentence, although it's right in the second sentence. The second camp is the interesting one. People in the second camp are deathly afraid of sounding like those in the first camp, but vague on the rules. So to play it safe, they underuse me and him. They'll say, he and I got a six-pack, which is correct, but also the six-pack is for he and I, which is incorrect. They'll also say things like, it's time for my husband and I to take a vacation.
Right.
This isn't a grammar lesson, but a simple self-check. Try your sentence without the other person in it. You wouldn't say, the IRS sent the refund check to I, so you shouldn't say, the IRS sent the refund check to my wife and I either, wrote Paul Bryans, a retired English professor at Washington State University. Nice. And of course, what I was hoping when I was talking to him is that, and I even asked him to mention that it's also a book called Common Errors in English Usage, which, right, has sold thousands of copies, and I, yep, was eagerly anticipating, ooh, people in the New York Times are going to hear about my book. Nope, just a retired professor at WSU.
Well, maybe they Google you and they find the book anyway. I think that's all the entries that I had sent to you.
Right.
And I will refer to people for more of this kind of content. The Common Errors in English Usage podcast is fantastic. I don't know how many episodes there are, but I downloaded them all and I've been working my way through. What I did is I went and picked through some of the interesting ones, like some of the ones about Christmas. I'm a Christian, and so I was interested in some of the Bible ones as well, words that come from Scripture. And so then I'm working my way through the rest of it.
But yes, and those, the host in that case is my publisher, editor of the book. Right. And yeah, so that was Tom. Yeah.
Tom Sumner.
Sumner, yeah. And he's very creative in finding ways to publicize the book, but he also selected the cartoons for the book, which are absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. I will have to get myself a copy of the book. But there's a lot of other interesting places that the podcast goes, because there's a series on a history of newspaper comics, which is fascinating. You sent me a video that you did just a while back, kind of talking about that history and kind of a dying art form in a lot of ways.
Right. I wanted to give you a little transition from English usage to science fiction.
Okay.
I got a message the other day from the computer services program, or department rather, at WSU, saying that my website had been targeted by malicious intruders who were trying to break into it and implant damaging software. And that there had been a huge spike in such attempts, and they wanted me to know that they were taking measures to redirect these people and block them from getting in. None of them had succeeded in penetrating. And I thought, I wonder if that has anything to do with the fact that on my site is the anti-Russian poetry of a Ukrainian poet, Lyubov Sirota, who experienced the Chernobyl disaster and was damaged by it and wrote poetry about it, and especially vitriolic poetry against the Russians. She since published a novel and a play and various other things. She's right now in exile in Poland. And I thought, I wonder if it's people trying to get at Luba that are coming from Russia. And the support person said, yeah, that's very possible. How I got connected with her was through having been asked to speak at a conference in Moscow on the nuclear arms race and the dangers of nuclear war. And I had done my research on nuclear war in fiction at that time. And so I was able to speak at this conference in a session where there were a couple of cosmonauts, which was really interesting, and filmmakers and so on. And so I had most of the stuff that I had studied for that was science fiction. So there you go. From
your site has been under attack by Russian robots.
Maybe.
So knows? There's a question. It kind of blends science fiction and English usage, the pronunciation of the word robot. Because the word robot does not go back really that far.
No.
But in early film, you always hear it robot.
Yes. Yeah.
And then it moved into more the robot.
Well, while we're on the subject of Russia, when I got back, people, Pullman, where WSU is situated, is right across the border with the University of Idaho.
Right. And Moscow.
Right, in the town of Moscow. And so when I got back, people said, well, do they say Moscow or Moscow? And I said, they say Moskva.
Right.
So you just argue among yourselves about what the correct pronunciation is.
Yeah, there's a great episode of the podcast where you talk about place names and how we pronounce things differently. You mentioned we have here just down the road between Hillsborough and Beaverton is a town called Aloha. Mm-hmm. And it's spelled like Aloha, but we all say Aloha.
By the way, my undergraduate degree is from Pacific University.
In Forest Grove.
In Forest Grove, yep.
Oh, fascinating. So yeah, kind of transitioning into talking about science fiction. You had mentioned the kind of as a tease, hey, I can maybe talk about why I think Star Wars was a disaster for science fiction cinema. So there's your hot take. So yeah. Run with it.
Well, I went the first night that it showed at our theater, and I had recently been really impressed by 2001: A Space Odyssey. And I thought, here's some serious science fiction. Arthur C. Clarke's involved. He's one of my favorite writers. And I thought it was really well done. A lot of people were going to it stoned. The idea was that this doesn't really mean anything. You just have to go, whoa, when it gets to the sequence where they're
through
going
the wormhole,
through. Right. Okay. I read the novel, and I said, well, okay, this makes perfect sense. It fits in with Clark's approach to hard science fiction. Yeah, it's technological, but it's also mystical.
Right.
His idea is that any culture that we meet is likely to be so much more advanced than us that they'll have almost godlike powers, and we won't be able to understand them, which is, interestingly enough, very similar to Stanisław Lem, the Polish science fiction writer, whose Solaris is on that theme, how you can try to study an alien civilization and find it utterly baffling because it's not human. You're not going to connect. It's hard to write stories in which no connection is made, but Lem did it. And the movies, which were made of that novel, didn't do justice at all to his premise. Anyway.
That's definitely one that's on my list of shame. I haven't. I do another podcast that's about adapted science fiction, and it's been on the list for a long time.
Yeah, you got to read the novel first.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so I had been reading Ursula Le Guin and Samuel R. Delaney and a lot of other newer writers who were really branching out and doing writing quite sophisticated science fiction. And Star Wars starts, and I said, oh my God, this is Buck Rogers. It's just, and yeah, George Lucas went to great lengths when he was first being interviewed about it to say, oh, this was inspired by a Japanese samurai movie, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I said, oh, I don't think so. And only much later in his career did he confess, yeah, this is sort of Buck Rogers, Flash Gordon updated.
Right. Yes.
So we're back in the 40s. You know, mm-hmm. So all the progress that science fiction had made of becoming more sophisticated, more subtle, more complex, all wiped out. And we're right back, bam, bam, shoot them. Ooh, let's build a weapon big enough to blow up a planet.
Right.
Under what circumstance would that make any sense at all? Who has the spare parts? If we could just sell everybody some coal to burn for a while, destroy the planet, or, you know, blow up a planet? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. It took what people who didn't read science fiction, didn't like science fiction, didn't know anything about science fiction, and said, this is what you think science fiction is.
Right.
And so he didn't call it science fiction. And that's why it starts out that it's in a far, far away.
Right.
It's not in our universe, actually. It's not just our galaxy. Mm-hmm. It's not in our realm of reality. Well, that was kind of cheating. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and it's just sort of taken over. And people now think, oh, that is the heart and soul of science fiction. And it's divided the world of literary science fiction from what the mass of people who are science fiction fans through movies think science fiction is all about. But it's just a variation of those chansons de geste, the French medieval stories about battles. Right. And so it's just killing each other. To me, even the notion of galactic empires and stuff has not made sense for a long, long time. When you know the scale of the universe, the speed of light, and all of that stuff, it's extremely unlikely that people will be able to make it from one inhabited planet to one in a different solar system.
Right.
And just alone, the radiation they're exposed to. Mm-hmm. Right now, NASA's fretting over trips to Mars and how to protect the people from getting over-radiated just on that short voyage. Yeah. If you're going to Alpha Centauri, forget about it.
Yeah.
And then think about other things. We're about to destroy our planet, essentially, in terms of making civilization possible. Now, if there is a window between the rise of industrialism and the destruction of your planet's being a livable place, there isn't time in there to develop the technology to do interstellar travel.
Right.
I wish we could phone up somebody on another planet and say, hey, you guys, you know, don't burn coal.
Right.
Really bad idea. So eventually I began to think, well, science fiction isn't really about science. I was drawn into it because I was interested in the science. I wanted to be a physicist. And then I wanted to be an astronomer. Well, my math skills were nil. So I couldn't do that. So science fiction was a way to me to sort of enjoy that world. But I was reading a lot about astronomy and nuclear physics. So I began to see that science fiction is not fiction about science. It's fantasy, which makes itself more credible by borrowing themes and images from science. So it provides a rationale. Instead of saying, well, there was a great wizard who put this sword in a stone, and if you pull it out, then great things happen. Mm-hmm. Instead, you use some bit of scientific research, and then you build your story on it. But you don't necessarily make it all rational. It's just not. I liked Isaac Asimov because he wrote about science and science fiction.
Right.
He wrote science fiction, but he also wrote nonfiction books, many, I don't remember how many he wrote, but a huge, huge number. So I was kind of addicted for a while when I was a kid to the Foundation trilogy. But I read it three or four times. But then later in life, I began to think, now, what justification is there for thinking that there are only humans are the only intelligent beings in the whole galaxy? That doesn't make any sense, that evolution wouldn't have produced some other intelligent beings. And he wrote a whole bunch of books in which robots become very important and become ultimately a serious problem. And the problem was that he didn't want them interfering with his Foundation-type series, so he kept the two separate until in his old age he tried to knit them back together kind of clumsily. But the idea that you can run a galactic empire the same way the Roman Empire did is just wacko. The time, the distance is just too overwhelming. And I was okay with his idea saying, okay, we'll see if we can project what the future will be like within certain probabilities. All right, that has a certain plausibility. And then his editor, who was really into paranormal phenomena, talked him into including ESP and the ability of to influence people's minds. And science fiction became infiltrated with that. Star Trek, half of their stories are about things that are not scientific phenomena at all. They're paranormal phenomena. And to me, that those are separate worlds.
Well, I mean, when I was thinking about, when you mentioned this to me, you know, why Star Wars has been bad, it kind of drew my mind back to where, when I was reading about Jaws and the impact that it had on summer films, because all of a sudden you have this thing that you, I don't know what the budget was, something very tiny, and it was a massive, massive hit. And then that took over. Now a summer movie has to be a blockbuster, or a studio is not going to sign off on it. They're not going to buy it. They're not going to do it, because this is what we want during this time, because money.
You know, I have kept my subscription to Netflix DVD by mail. I also have the Netflix streaming, and we watch it a lot. But one of the things that we get there is a lot of foreign films. You know, the U.S. is not the only filmmaking place in the world. They make far more films in India than we do in the United States. So when you feel like something other than another superhero movie, it's really nice to get a nice Turkish movie in the mail, or something from Kyrgyzstan. You never know what's going to pop up.
True. And I mean, there are a lot of films from India that you can watch them, and they're more bombastic and ridiculous than any superhero film.
We watched RRR the other night.
Yeah, we did too. And
it's almost a parody of a Indian film. Absolutely ridiculous. But it's also, it falls into the same thing that Star Wars does: battling, blowing things up, killing lots of people, spectacular violence. To me, I always was really interested in Philip K. Dick, because Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep is really about trying to get past violence and trying to understand each other. And I had an interesting experience. I was invited to Germany. I was sent there by a State Department program to talk at a conference on science fiction, and I showed them the movie Blade Runner, which is based on Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep. Half the audience, the Germans, walked out in halfway through because they said, oh, this is just American violence, you know, disgusting. And I told them the next day when I talked about it, I said, this is actually against violence. You know, this is really trying to convey a different message. And I think the idea that we will all keep behaving forever, no matter how much higher technology gets and how many different kinds of creatures we meet, we're still going to fight the same kind of stupid wars. We're still going to have the same macho attitudes. You know, nothing's, human nature doesn't change. Asimov was a believer in that, by the way. He often would say, oh, you know, people don't change. Well, I think that's not true. I think that human civilization can change. And that's right now, the Russians are going through a real backlash. But I don't think we're destined always to be as violent, and people don't have to be as cruel and as transcendently evil as you get in Star Wars.
I'll have to put in the show notes that comic that you sent me the other day that was about a father lamenting that one of his children preferred Star Wars to Star Trek, and how in Star Trek, you know, it's about how we can understand each other and overcome our problems without violence. And in Star Wars, they just blow things up.
They did quite a bit of violence in Star Trek too. And the way they could satisfy the audience's desire for violence was to have the enemy do it. Mm-hmm. It's the aliens.
Yeah. But even when you look at some of the original Trek films, Star Trek, the motion picture, is very much not a film where there's a violent solution to it. You know, it is about understanding.
Right.
Where you get into some of the Next Generation films, and they just turned them into action movies. They turned them into Star Wars. And the same thing with the J.J. Abrams films. They're basically Star Wars movies. I still like them, but they're not the same thing.
Wasn't the series, was it Deep Space Nine? Was that the name?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was my only favorite Star Trek series because I thought the plots were more inventive. So many of the plots were just rehashes of stories that had been done to death in other forms. They weren't really inventive. Yes. Somebody like Dick or Ursula Le Guin really tried to think up new stories. And to me, that's one of the nice things about science fiction. It gives you the freedom. Right? I never have understood why murder mysteries have so much more prestige than science fiction does. Because to me, the murder mystery has some very tight prescriptions on it. One thing it does is a lot of the author's effort goes into misleading you.
Yes.
And so you're being told things which you think are clues, but they turn out not to be relevant at all. And you're being introduced to characters who are going to turn out to be very different from how you thought they were. Mm-hmm. Now, in any other kind of writing, do you do that? Do you try to? No, you try to get to know the characters better. And as you reach the end of the novel, you feel enriched. And suddenly, And British TV, it's almost always the woman that did it. Oh, who would have thought? We thought this was all these guys that did it. Mm. You know, it's the unlikely ending. And people like that little surprise, you know.
Right.
Fun. Okay,
right.
But it's the same thing over and over. I know there's elegant ways of doing it. And I've read quite a lot of detective stories. I've actually enjoying this new series called Astrid. There's 9 episodes, and it's French. It was produced in France, but it is being aired. Well, it's not being aired at all. It's not broadcast, but it's available streaming if you're a donor to your local PBS station. And it's about an autistic woman who works in an archive of criminal investigations, and she memorizes everything. She has a photographic memory, but she's hopeless in dealing with the outside world and has to wear headphones over just to block out the noise. And it's a very sympathetic portrait of an autistic person. Mm. And she works side by side with a woman who is a regular police detective. And, their interactions are really interesting, and the solutions to the mysteries, again, a little far-fetched, but I like that one. That was it's quite interesting, and it's I was thinking, well, how's that having a detective who just doesn't understand figures of speech and doesn't understand people's emotions, but can put her finger right on facts. And I thought, you know, that's not unlike Sherlock Holmes.
Right, right.
He was pretty socially inept, too.
Mm-hmm. Going back to something you said about the kind of Clark's Law, right, about advanced technology being indistinguishable from magic, or
you know,
aliens being incomprehensible to us because their technology is so far above us. There was one of the nominees for the Hugo Award for Best Novella last year from Adrian Tchaikovsky called Elder Race, where that's precisely what you have an advanced person who's on a planet that's more primitive. And when she speaks to him and he speaks back to her, he will speak and it will show what he says. And what he says is this high technology science fiction language. She interprets it as magical. He's a priest, you know, of an elder god or something. And because that's the only way she can understand it. She comprehends it as being this fantasy setting, but he's speaking it from a science fiction setting. It's a fascinating thing. It was one of my favorites last year.
Yeah. By the way, I did, during most of my career, subscribe to Locus. I don't know. Is that still around?
Yep.
Okay. Then when I started publishing, I did several articles or a few articles for Science Fiction Studies, which is the academic journal dealing with science fiction. And it's something that's one of the things that annoys me is together with Vladimir Gakov, who's the guy that got me invited to Moscow, he put together and I edited a bibliography of nuclear Holocaust science fiction written in Russian, because Americans were convinced that Russians were not allowed to write about real nuclear war happening. Mm. And of course, when I went to Moscow, they were showing Letters from a Dead Man, which is essentially a nuclear winter Holocaust story. It's very moving and powerful movie. It was completely unknown in the West, but it was a huge hit in Russia. It was shown everywhere. We played for months and months and months. Everybody was going to it. I actually met the director and the script writer. And we put together a bibliography of that kind of thing. And Science Fiction Studies has put up online reproducing selected articles from some of their issues. And if the issue is still available, if they've got copies they're willing to sell, they don't put it online. But for that particular issue in which that bibliography appeared, they've put online two different articles, but not ours.
Oh, bummer. We've sort of already talked a little bit about this, at least as regards science fiction film, but in the course of your being in academic life and teaching science fiction, did you see shifts in the kind of science fiction that was published? Or has it changed in major ways? I mean, I know you mentioned when I first reached out to you, I haven't read much science fiction since I retired.
Right.
Or
even in the last 20 years. So,
okay.
There was a year period of about 20 years there where I read quite a bit, but that's long past. So I'm not an authority on what's going on in science fiction now.
Okay.
Although I had an interesting other encounter that had to do with the website. There's a group of academics at Cambridge University in England who are trying to work up a symposium on dangers of nuclear war and how to avoid it, particularly in relation to the Russian threat to use nuclear bombs in Ukraine.
Right.
And they ran across my book, Nuclear War and Fiction, is complete on the web. Mm-hmm. It's much longer than the book, actually, because I read a lot more books after that. And so they asked me to contribute to it. And they said, if you happen to be in London this spring, you can join us. I don't think so, but I've sent them written stuff, and they were very grateful for it. And so that's another angle where the website has got me involved in something international.
Hmm. So let's move into talking about recommendations from you. For science fiction books or science fiction fantasy books and movies.
Right. Well,
we don't have to go through all of them. You sent me a long list. I'll make sure to share it with listeners.
Well. Samuel R. Delaney's Trouble on Triton is one I liked. And if you bought the book when it first came out, it was just called Triton. Mm. And he had asked it to be Trouble on Triton. He wanted to use this sort of wowie, zowie, old-fashioned science fiction title. And he managed, when it finally got reprinted, republished, to get his real title, Trouble on Triton. Mm. And it's a exploration, among other things, of his gay experience and his attitudes. Mm-hmm. he is, of course, a black writer, a gay writer, and a gay guy who likes to make love with dirty old men. I mean, bums. White men. Yeah. So he kind of breaks down all the barriers.
Right.
But Triton, I think, is his best book. And okay. It's really entertaining, and it gets into the social thing. He's trying to imagine a society in which people really have freedom. You have absolute freedom, sexual freedom, of course, but a lot of other kinds of freedom, and you can be who you need to be. And for him, that's a crucial issue, because he's a very special kind of person, doesn't fit in categories. And Ursula Le Guin's The Dispossessed is another one, where people often imagine dictatorships in science fiction. That's really common. Mm-hmm. And then if it's a socialist organization, then it's got to be like Russia. It's got to be Stalinist and oppressive. And so she sets up a situation in which you have three systems. You have anarchists, not in the way that non-anarchists talk about anarchism,
right,
but the way anarchists talk about anarchism. Mm-hmm. And that's where the beginning of the book is. That interested me especially because my master's thesis was partly about Zola's Germinal, Emile Zola's Germinal, which is about a coal miner strike in 18th century France. And it introduces us to anarchism, to socialism. It's the only novel that I know of in the 19th century that tries to give a fair voice to leftists instead of just seeing them as being bomb throwers. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really exceptional. So she does this, but she sees advantages and disadvantages in that society. Then you're introduced to a very wealthy capitalistic society, which gives you lots of food and wealth and comfort, but only for the upper class.
Right.
And it's very exploitive. Mm-hmm. And then you have a sort of Stalinist society, which says it's socialist, but it's really a dictatorship. So you've got all three of these, and with one interesting man who doesn't quite fit in any one of them and travels from one to the next. She got criticized by some women writers who said, well, why did you have to have a man doing it? This is right during the beginning of the feminist second wave, which I thought was a little unfair. And she certainly done other things about women as well. But to me, it's still a really interesting book.
So yeah, that's an excellent one.
I recommend that.
I wanted to ask about, on your list, you mentioned Harlan Ellison's stories, and then in quotations you say, not science fiction.
Yeah, okay. I always enjoyed reading Harlan Ellison because he was so inventive. Mm-hmm. And he wrote strictly short stories, which means that people who only read novels wouldn't run into Harlan Ellison.
Right.
But some of his stuff was clearly fantasy. Some of it was horror. It was all kinds of things. And he would surprise you. It was very inventive and original. It wasn't just always the same old thing. So one year I went to this conference in Florida, the International Association for the Fantastic and the Arts. And I don't know if the organization still exists, but I used to go to it. And it has horror stories, ghost stories, fantasy, and science fiction, and its academic approaches too. And they have their speakers are major writers, and Ellison was the featured keynote address giver. And it just the day before, he had been interviewed by a new local newspaper reporter, and he'd gone on, and Ellison loved to talk about himself at great length and what his writing was all about. So he's trying to convey how complex and varied it was. And they put a headline when the article was published in the paper calling SF writer Harlan Ellison. And he blew up. He did not want to be called a science fiction writer. And he spent the entire hour, we sat there just cringing, having our lunch remains sitting in front of us, listening to this guy just ranting at this reporter who was there sitting in the audience and just telling him how stupid and disgusting and evil it was to call him a science fiction writer. Oh, boy. I never quite felt the same about it again.
Yeah. There's an old video I've referenced it many times on the podcast where he was on the Sci-Fi Vortex on the Sci-Fi Channel and was ranting about the term sci-fi. Because to him, it's a term meant to diminish, you know, fiction that's in a certain genre. And I think he just didn't like the genre labels, right? I know Vonnegut didn't like being called a science fiction writer either.
Yeah. Well, of course, sci-fi is one of the terms in my common errors in English usage too, because most people don't realize that people who are really into it usually say SF, but as I point out in that entry, the trouble with SF is to everybody else, that means San Francisco.
Right. Yeah. So you also mentioned Metropolis, and there's an interesting subnote on it as
well. Yeah. When I taught science fiction film, which I did for 2 years, I guess, toward the end of my career, and very big classes, I always started with Metropolis, and a lot of people have a hard time sitting still for a silent movie made in Germany, you know, subtitles. It's one of the greatest science fiction films ever made, and it has a strong social element to it, but it has some real futuristic visual material as well. And I would follow that up, by the way, by the Japanese anime Metropolis, which is completely different, but loosely connected. But some years ago, I've always been interested in graphic novels and comic strips, and Disney comics in particular. I don't get so excited about superheroes. You know, I read Superman and Batman when I was a kid. I always liked Batman better than Superman. But to me, Scrooge McDuck was far more interesting, and he had a lot of interesting adventures. And Disney kept Scrooge out of their movies, the world between the comics, where Scrooge was really important, and the movies was great for a long, long time, for many decades. And eventually, of course, he has his own show on TV. But the Europeans did something interesting. The Disney comics became so popular that they began to be written in places like the Netherlands, and then translated into different languages, Icelandic, Czech. I started collecting them in my travels and picking them up, and I have, 15 different languages, maybe, in which there are Disney comics. Now, many of the writers were Americans, but they got published in other languages, not in the United States. For long periods of time, the adventures of Mickey Mouse as an adventurer, often toting a gun in the early days, solving crime cases against Pete, known originally as Pegleg Pete, then Black Pete, and then just plain Pete, is I can get lost in that world. Anyway, I loved those long serials when I was a kid. Well, it turned out that Europeans did too, and the Italians in particular started doing these long graphic stories, much longer than American comics were ever allowed to have. Very complicated. Written in Italian, they would often get translated into French and Dutch and German and so on. The first one was actually Mickey Mouse on a tour of hell, reenacting Dante's Inferno with Goofy as Virgil. But it was such a success in Italy that they started doing other works like Treasure Island, War and Peace. You know, you name a great classic, and they've made a Disney parody of it. And they're wonderful, but very, very few of them have been translated into English. The Dante one has been. But my favorite, above all, is Metropolis. And it's Mickey Mouse is the star, and the female lead is Minnie. And you have a whole bunch of laborers who look just like Goofy.
Right.
But it follows the plot quite closely, and the art is stunning. It's just beautiful, beautiful book. And it's been reprinted in lavish hardcovers, which I own. And I go to Amazon.it, Italy. And it costs more to ship the books to me than it does for the books. And I don't really read Italian fluently, but my wife has studied Italian. She studied in Italy for a while. So every night we sit down and read a couple pages of these Italian adventures and translate together. And I sit there with my iPad looking up the words that she doesn't know. But the Metropolis, if you've got to read one Disney parody, and I think you should because they're really wonderful, Metropolis would be the one.
I'll recommend it to a friend of mine who's learning Italian. So down in the fantasy recommendations, you have the Oz books, which I think I've only read the first one, just The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. I read it to my son when he was young.
Yeah. Well, you know, I discovered I was addicted to those when I was a kid. I had a cousin who had the whole collection, and every time we visited, I got to borrow one more volume of the Oz books. And so I knew those before I knew the movie. Yeah. And one of the things that's different about the books in the movie is that in the book, Dorothy has silver shoes.
Right.
Well, when they were making a Technicolor movie, they thought it would be much more interesting to have ruby slippers.
Right.
And of course, after the original author died, other writers took over the Oz series, and there's still people writing Oz books today, one a year. And I'm not totally into them, but they had a big influence on me.
One thing that I found interesting when I read The Wonderful Wizard of Oz to my son was the movie very much plays up the character traits of the cowardly lion and the Tin Man without a heart, where the book very clearly shows that they all have the thing that they say that they want. They don't need the wizard to do anything. It's there all along.
Right.
Because the lion is very, very brave. He just doesn't think he is.
But there's something about it. That's the other thing that's really different about the books. Mm. The movie says it's no place like home, right?
Right.
And so, yes, I'm so glad to be happy to be back in black and white Kansas. Mm-hmm. Well, that was a big mistake because L. Frank Baum and his audience wanted more Oz. And so ultimately, Dorothy goes back to Oz, becomes a princess, her aunt and uncle go with her. Mm-hmm. Toto, of course, they become immortal. Mm-hmm. The rest is, forget about Kansas.
Right.
You know, it's much more interesting to be in Oz. So that idea that the Wizard of Oz is all about, forget fantasy, go back to the real world.
Yeah. You have some classics in the fantasy. I mean, the Oz books are classic as well, but you have the Odyssey and Faust as well.
Yeah, I taught Faust for many years, Goethe's Faust. The second part, except for the last scene, he was trying to cash in on the popularity of the first part and put everything in there that he wanted. But the first part of Goethe's Faust is wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. I also mentioned Marie de France's Lays, and I have a special relationship to that because when I was doing my first book, The Body Tales from the Courts of Medieval France, I was the first person to translate one of her lays into English. So I feel a special connection there. Mm. Now there are nice, complete translations of all of her lays, but she's the first woman writer of fantastic fiction. Mm. And Satanic Verses, I spent 5 years creating a study guide for that because it's full of illusions, not illusions, but allusions. Right. And it's almost impossible to read. It's if you don't know a lot, he's playing games, constantly dropping hints from old movies, from Sanskrit, from Arabic, from comic books, from news stories, and he's just playing games and enjoying himself. And of course, all the publicity was about the Iranians' attempt to assassinate him,
right?
Which recently almost succeeded.
Yeah.
And but what I did was start working on the web, trying to annotate it so that people could actually read the book because it sold very well, but hardly anybody got past the first chapter. Mm. And I made connections finally with 4 graduate students in different countries, and they were all doing work on this novel. And we collaborated online and just zapping back and forth ideas and writing up, but none of them wanted their name attached to it because they were afraid of being stabbed by somebody, like the translator of Japan was stabbed to death.
Yeah.
So that was something I felt very strongly about. And I think I've had different classes. Somebody at Yale said he'd taught the course and had his students use the study guide. And I rarely get anything from it, but I spent a lot of time on that. But that is a fantastic novel. And if you just use my study guide, it doesn't give away things. It does summarize the plot so you can find out what's happening. Okay. But you can actually enjoy reading it.
Hmm. Is that available on the site?
Yes.
Okay. That's one that's been on my list. I've wanted to read it for a while. I don't think I ever realized that it was fantasy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, yes, it turns out with the two main characters turning one into an angel and the other into a devil.
Okay. So you mentioned early in our correspondence that since retiring, you've gone back and started reading things that you had not been reading for the 20 years that you were, or however long it was you were teaching science fiction. So if there's anybody out there who's like me, I'm approaching the end of my project on my podcast, and I'm looking at what do I want to read. I have a huge list of things that I want to read. Some of them still in science fiction, just not ones that are on the list that I'm reading. But there's also some classics that I'd like to go back and fill in. So you want to give us a few recommendations from a literature professor?
Okay. On the list that I sent you, there's a lot of classics and things that lots of people have read. Mm-hmm. One that did sell quite well and is well known, I want to mention Sherman Alexie. Sherman Alexie was actually a student in my science fiction class.
Oh, wow.
He went to WSU, mostly through the Spokane branch, and he wasn't that happy with our English program, to tell you the truth. But he and I developed a not unfriendly situation. I've had him autograph his books for me at a couple occasions. And I really admire him as a writer. I gave him a B in that class, and I don't remember well enough what his writing was like. But he was very interested in science fiction. He doesn't write it himself. He writes about Native American stuff. And right. His most well-known book is Reservation Blues, which okay. I'd recommend highly. David Gooderson's Snow Falling on Cedars has a special connection because it's about the exile of Japanese to right. concentration camps during World War II. And it started here, where I live, on Bainbridge Island. Mm. And that's where Gooderson lives, too. Now, he sets his story on a different island, but it's really Bainbridge. Okay. I mean, everything about it is Bainbridge. And there's a memorial on the site where they were first put on the ships that now has some really interesting sculptures on it. So I think Gooderson is a wonderful writer, just absolutely not to be missed. The other local writer I really recommend is Jonathan Evason, whose books are really good. And I especially enjoyed his last one, Small World. He's got another new one I just read about today. But that's about a lawyer and his old age.
Okay. Well, that's a good Northwest connection for me.
Yeah. Another book that I really enjoyed, and I'm not quite sure how to pronounce this, is a Dutch writer, Ilja Leonard Pfeiffer, and it's spelled Pfeijffer. Okay. And the title is Grand Hotel Europa. And he's one of these writers who writes what they call autofiction. He talks about the writing of the book that you're reading as he's some of the chapters telling you how he's writing it. And it's not really about this grand hotel. That's his location he's retreated to write his book. It's about this relationship with a woman in Venice and his life there. And so he's absolutely stunning. There are some people recommend another book of his is better, but I really think that Grand Hotel Europa, if you're going to read one book by him, I would read it. And it's just very imaginative. And he also can seem extremely politically incorrect. And you think, oh my God, how is he saying these things about immigrants or women? But then you see, oh, on this other page, there's a totally different point of view than somebody else that's being represented. And he often makes himself look foolish or or bigoted or limited in some way. A lot of it is not boasting and saying, you know, like a Hemingway posturing, but instead, you know, what's wrong with me?
Right.
So I like that a lot.
Well, excellent. I'll make sure to make this list available to folks. We didn't really talk about the science fiction movies. We did mention a few of them in passing during that discussion.
Oh, one other author I wanted to mention in under fantasy, Leonie Ross, L-E-O-N-E, Popisho, P-O-P-I-S-H-O. She's a Jamaican descent, and it's set on an island which is sort of like a magical Jamaica, in which everybody, as they develop into adolescence, gets a superpower. And you never know what it's going to be like. And except that this one character seems to not be developing a superpower, and she feels totally isolated. It's not like the, it's a reversal of the theme of the weird kid who gets isolated. Instead, it's the one who doesn't have any weirdness about her. But it is just so rich, and the story is wonderful. The relationships among the people are just fabulously described. I can't recommend it highly enough.
Cool. We've been chatting a long time, Paul, and I don't want to eat up any more of your time. So I'll move towards summing up here. So, I mean, before I let you go, do you have any online presence other than the website? Are you active on any social media that you want to promote?
Facebook.
Okay.
You know, a lot of young people like to think that, nobody uses Facebook. It's all TikTok or whatever. People who are over 40 make up a majority of the population. And there's more people on Facebook in the world than on any other site. So, if I want to address people in their 20s, maybe that wouldn't be the place to be. But it is wonderful for me because what I do there is my photography. In retirement, I really got into photography, and I share my pictures on there. I occasionally other little things too, but it's almost entirely about.
Now, you have photos on the website as well.
Yes, but those were before I got very good.
Okay.
That's when I was teaching a course in world civilizations, and I was taking pictures for my travels to be used in the class. But when I moved in 2008 to Bainbridge Island, I got introduced to a photo club where I learned a lot in the early days of digital photography, and I've gotten more and more sophisticated. I have an exhibit that just went up this weekend at the Senior Center here, where they have a whole wall with my photos up on them, and I'll be doing a podcast talking about that, and I can send you a link to it later. Yeah. That'll be happening this coming Thursday, I think.
Okay, well, that's great. And then I will refer people over to the website and also the podcast because there's a topic for all interests there. There's movie talk as well as the
And usage. Buy the book.
What's that?
Buy the Common Errors book. It's
cheap. There you go.
It's like $18, I think, now.
Okay.
And it's easier to navigate actually than the website. On the website, you have to click on one entry at a time, and it's hard if you just settle down to read. My favorite letters have been, like you just said, somebody said, "I just went to your site I started looking up something in your book, and now I've wasted 2 hours because I couldn't stop reading it."
I've definitely done that. Yeah. But the book has more of the illustrations as well, right?
Yes. What they did was to take 19th century engravings and then put new captions on them.
Oh, fun.
And that was Tom Sumner and his family did that, and they're very clever. And then he did even more for the page a day calendars that you mentioned that we did for 3 years.
Nice.
Oh, maybe it was more like 5 years. Nobody does those anymore.
Well, you have my commitment. I will obtain a copy of the book, and I'll invite my listeners to do the same.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot. This has been fun.
Yeah. Thanks, Paul. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you so much sometimes I send out inquiries. I never hear anything back, and I'm always delighted when I'm able to make the connection and have a conversation, even if it's sort of meandering, the way they tend to be. But, it's been a pleasure. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Paul. I thought it was really a lot of fun chatting with him. I did want to mention, actually, kind of in the postscript here, that Paul was nice enough to reach out to his publisher to send me a copy of the Common Errors in English Usage book. So I will include a picture of the book. And I've been enjoying just kind of having it as my nightstand book, where before bed I can just page through it a little bit, read a few entries, and laugh a little bit, learn something. It's fun. So I highly recommend that you pick up a copy of the book as well. It's just cool to, you know, have a platform where I can find somebody that I want to talk to and then post an episode about it. And on that note, I actually want to let you know that as I'm getting down to the end of my list for Hugh Goes There, I have put together a little bit of a survey through a Google form. And I am sending that out on social media. By the time this episode goes live, it should be there. I'll pin it probably on Twitter. So if you want to see that, you can do that, and I'll put it on other social media as well. But if you're not on social media and you want to be a part of helping shape the future of the podcast, then do let me know. Just reach out to me, feedback@hugospodcast.com, and I'll make sure that you get access to it as well. Or you can just shoot me an email, sort of unsolicited, and just fire away with whatever your opinions are. And I think that's about it for this episode. So look for that link, reach out to me if you can't find it. And thanks for listening.